HPPodCraft.com.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the comment show for May here on HP Podcraft, Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. We're going to look back at the stories we covered about the future. And that starts with Black Destroyer. Alice Lehman writes, I think it's the leeching aspect that makes a vampire. Haha. Not the often near total dietary restriction. Remember, I was asking, you know,
yes.
If you're vegetarian, are you just a vampire for vegetables? What's going on here?
Yeah.
Although now I'm wondering where carnivorous plants fall, since they tend to do it specifically for nitrogen, but also just wholly engulf the whole bug or whatever. Anyway, that section really took me back to a discussion about cannibal sharks in an old episode, Three Skeleton Key, maybe. So please, more taxonomy segments.
All right.
Well, maybe that is what it is. I was saying, you know, it's about the stealing.
Yes.
That's what makes you a vampire.
It's not the stealing. It's about the stealing while the person still lives. Because if you're stealing something and they die, then it doesn't matter. Like it's like when if I killed an animal and ate it, I'm stealing the meat of it, not the bone.
Right. That's true.
I don't eat the hair. You only eat certain parts of the animal generally. With a vampire, I think for something to be vampiric, it takes its sustenance off you, but leaves you alive, or at least for a time.
I was going to say, so if a vampire kills somebody while they're doing it, it's okay.
Yeah, it's fine.
You're still living afterwards. No bueno.
To Sir with Lovecraft writes, as to how the commander got his position, in the Space Beagle, we learned that the crew voted him in. There are elections in later chapters. The story was changed for the novel to include the main character of the remaining stories, a man who uses logic to solve problems, like Spock if Spock were a Scientologist. He is a Nexialist, Dianetics, and the stories suffer from his inclusion.
I wonder if the commander is tall. That might be what got him elected. Because it's certainly not his brains. He's probably no. 6'5 or something, and they thought, that seems like a smart man. Christine McCann writes, highbrow analysis. It's interesting that the ship is the Beagle, because the explorer's key failure was to ignore the scientific approach and instead go forward in a very colonialist mentality. Look at this novel life form. Surely it poses no harm to us superior humans. Lowbrow summary. Their hubris led them into messing with some weird alien pussy.
Pussycat.
It's true.
It's cat-like. Yes, of course.
You should pitch Cardi B on weird alien pussy. She might get into it.
Oh, I bet she would.
I'm a fan, you know.
Oh, yeah. Who's not?
That's a good question. We'll get into that next comment show.
Steve writes, Van Vogt was a big hit amongst the geeky crowd in my high school in France in the late 70s. I read everything. So I read this and the world of Null A and its sequels. It was all badly written and I never understood the attraction, but I understood it a bit more now having seen Star Trek The Next Generation. Ooh, zing!
Wow. Well, way to bury the lead, Steve. See what it says there? I read everything.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
I believe it.
That's a pretty incredible accomplishment to be reading everything.
Steve Dempsey has a library. He built a building in his garden that is just a library.
And it stops in the 70s. That's when he read everything. And after that, he was like, I'm done. As far as I know, chest hair and mustaches, still super cool.
Steve had a copy of Haunted Quad Cities, and he lent it to me.
He had that?
He just had it.
I think that book is a ghost. That's how haunted it is. I've never heard of such a thing. Shana Carter writes, the key to understanding the end of Black Destroyer is Morton's line. He couldn't know that by stopping. We flashed past him at millions of miles a second. Here's what I think happens. Curl launches the human ship into space, then leaves in his escape vessel. However, both the humans and Curl are still orbiting the planet. After Curl's exit, the humans use their anti-accelerator to maintain their position relative to the world's surface while Curl's ship circles the planet and winds up back where he started. Yeah, I think that's probably what happened. Okay. As for Ellison calling Slan the best mutant story, I've always seen it as peak fanboy wish fulfillment. You have superhuman powers. Your parents died protecting you, which means you have absolute proof of their love, but don't have to deal with them. And they left you a secret lair full of cool gadgets. During your adventures, you meet two women, a tough brunette who shows you the ropes, and a blonde to rescue. And because Slans are endangered, you are not only permitted but encouraged to woo them both.
Woo!
That does sound pretty great. I might dig into that one.
Alias Sionji writes, you guys were down on the ending, but your reader really sold it to me. At least I like the idea of the twist. The real horror, the lurking evil, was mankind all along. Not a novel idea, but I saw promise in the trappings of the story. That ending made me reevaluate the way in which most characters seemed basically unbothered by the deaths of their crewmates. Whether intentional or accidental, the selfish indifference of to death in retrospect now reads as foreshadowing. Maybe someone should fix up this story to make the crew less infuriatingly stupid.
Yeah, this story definitely needs some fix-ups. Thanks, George Woodruff, for being a great reader on that episode and pulling it out at the end there for something that, yeah, we were down on it, and I think I'm still down on it. Andrew Brown writes, being that guy, I believe the reference to the heading for his son is simply the direction. And I went back and I looked at the passage, and he's right. Remember I said that he's going to the sun, and there'll be other monsters and tunnels in the sun? Well, it's just poorly written. He's heading that way, and then he says, there will be monsters and tunnels, and I'll get him, and we'll go live somewhere safe. So it sounds like he's talking about the sun, but on closer inspection, which I'm not sure the story merits. I'm kidding. I find out I was wrong. So thank you, Andrew. Also, Andrew writes, I love Golden Age science fiction, but they were often obsessed with physics and calculations. It could be interesting, but let's be honest, when you're going between stars and have implied artificial gravity, it seems silly.
Yeah.
To go into it, yeah.
Carlandos writes, when you mentioned the Corel, it immediately triggered my nerd sense. It's a cat-like creature that features prominently in the Final Fantasy series of the game.
A lot of people brought up Final Fantasy. Jason Thompson writes, the idea a super advanced civilization that collapsed and the individual members now live as low-tech solitary predators, even though they could make technology if they wanted to. I can't tell if that's brilliant or completely stupid. Jason, I think everybody feels that way about this story, and then that's the reason it endures, because it's both.
Yeah.
As much as I complained, I liked that everybody was dumb. I mean, I did. It was just like a great B-movie, so, you know, it's a backhanded compliment, but I did.
It's still a compliment.
Yeah.
Robert Curtin writes, is Coral perhaps one of the cats of Jupiter that the cats of Ulthar in Dream Quest were so afraid of? Could be.
Perhaps. I think yes. Yeah.
I'm going to say absolutely, positively, that's canon.
Yep, that's canon as well. Oh, wait, can we decide what's canon now?
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Why not? Who's going to stop us?
I love it. Well, it starts today. The cats of Jupiter are Quirrells. Yes.
Episode 543, The Vaults of Yovambis.
Shuggoth Lord writes, also, I know you were making a joke when you referenced tasting the ground, Chad, but apparently one of the fundamental tools for identifying rocks in the geologist's tool belt is, okay, but how does it taste when I lick it? That's true. I seem to have forgotten, but I did take geology, and I did taste some rocks my own self.
What?
I did. When you have to identify the basic kinds of rocks, I remember there were certain kinds of tests, and one of them was to taste it for salt.
Yeah, okay.
I got a D in that class, so maybe I was just tasting it because I was hungover. I don't know. You know, I wanted something salty. But no, I'm pretty... Ben A. follows up. As much fun as licking rocks and artifacts can be, that's how we claim ownership of objects in the field, after all. I can attest that licking objects to determine if they're bone, wood, ceramic, metal, or rock is a bad idea and not regular practice, at least in archaeology. For one, it could contaminate the object or contaminate you, like who wants splinters or bone dust on their tongue. Well, bone dust, I might like.
Yeah, that's
more importantly, licking potentially ethically sensitive materials, fun though it might be, is questionable. Licking objects also might summon Sothagua.
Makes sense.
Because you lick toads, so you know you are getting into the toad realm with that. Yep. Now, when it was a sample case where they were trying to help you identify schist versus, well, I got a D, I don't remember anything else, but the other rocks that you had to look at, tasting was something that you would do. Now, out in the field, I don't know, as Ben points out, if that's something you want to get involved in, you don't know what weird kid's been rubbing their hand on that or something. I think another commenter mentioned that. And then also, the joke is based on that character in Star Wars, who I guess I'm made to understand was a soldier with a geology hobby who just likes to identify his environment through that one testing method.
Yeah. Well, because it freaks people out. They're like, my God, what are you doing eating that stuff? And he goes, well, in geology, that's how we do it.
Oh, man. You just put the finishing touch on making that character amazing, though, to be honest. Because I'm making a joke, but a guy who realized that he could learn about materials by tasting them and then trots that out constantly, it kind of reminds me of, I just read an Onion headline that was like, guy gets a little bit of a thrill telling people that John Lennon beat his wife. And I know that guy. He can't wait. Oh, everybody's singing Imagine. I'm going to this one up. So I think, yeah, that soldier is just like, he tastes stuff and people are freaked out. And then he goes, it's actually not that weird, guys. And then they're all like, we're in for a lecture now. I just met... Who's dating him? Who brought him here? Anyway, we should move on.
Robert Curtin writes, head crabs. This monster is so reminiscent of Half-Life, or more likely, the zombies in the series were channeling this story. They are very similar to how they ambush prey and then kill/control their host as it decays to find food and defend its territory. Fantastic story. I definitely recommend this one, perhaps the abridged edition to friends. I used to play Half-Life. I totally remember those head crabs.
It was scary then, and it's scary now. Sanjay Matthew writes, speaking of the stupidly hubristic protagonists of the golden age of science fiction, isn't this the writers either straightforwardly echoing or knowingly riffing on the great white adventurers of Victorian / Edwardian boys adventure fiction that contributed quite a bit of genetic material to the pulps? Yeah, absolutely. Look, part of the reason I wanted to read Candide is because I felt like that quest narrative is embedded way back there, and then we saw all these iterations as we got into what are the crazy realms we can send somebody into. I think it even goes back before we get into the colonialism stuff, where it's just about stranger in a strange land, and that person's not always going to behave by the rules or very intelligently at all. No. But I have some more thoughts on that. We'll get to it.
Cole Karin writes, a lot of real historical explorers came across as this dumb with hindsight, too. Many real people have died in search of mythical lost cities, and I wouldn't be surprised if they sounded like this from the perspective from some other narrator. Nobody voyages into the unknown without some amount of unearned confidence. If they survive, their rugged individualist instead of hubris made manifest. I'm not going to fault Alan Octave for not realizing he's a character in a pulp science fiction story. You still shouldn't huff ancient Martian vault gas, though.
No. And I hear what you're saying, although, and you're not being this way, but I find that in these discussions, people are a little disingenuous because it's more fun to argue about these things than it is to just admit that there's just bad character logic.
Oh, sure.
People will say, when you point out a character doing something dumb, there's people doing dumb things because, yes, people do very dumb things all the time. Explorers do dumb things. I do dumb things. Everybody does. But it's when it's inconsistent with the logic that's set up in the story that it's a little alarming. You know, sometimes people, and some of these comments popped up here, like, oh great, let's just read something where everybody does everything right. That'll be interesting. And that's a paper tiger. I'm obviously not advocating for that. Or no. They'll say, well, yeah, it was the person did a dumb thing, but if they don't do that, then you don't have any conflict.
That's not true.
You know, that's not the only way to generate conflict, certainly. Or some people will say, oh, you're complaining about the character's weird choice, but you have no problem that they're flying around in outer space or whatever. And again, it's like, what are these arguments? Stop faking like you're dumb for the sake of argument. These are either-or scenarios that don't exist. Stories are better when the characters make decisions that feel right within the universe that's set up for the story. Mm-hmm. So if it's a universe where dogs talk and you tell me to accept that, I'll accept it. But if people act inconsistently and weird in that universe, it bothers me. And so like in Alien, they broke quarantine. Dumb thing to do. But they did it because they really cared for another crew member. It was a really human bad decision. We talk a lot about how Ripley was telling them they should have listened to her. If you had something stuck on your face and they were saying I couldn't let you, my friend Chris, into the ship, I'd probably break quarantine.
Well, hold on. An Alien as well. Do you remember who actually broke quarantine?
Oh, it was the android, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was the android. Right. Ash was the one that broke quarantine. And so they all wanted it to happen. So it made sense that he would do it and get away with it because they all wanted it to happen. But he was the one. He knew what was going on. He wanted to collect that sample. And that's an example of, okay, we've got a premise here. Nobody's making any mistakes. Nobody did anything wrong. They were just in a bad situation. And it was the slow realization of how bad that situation actually was.
Oh, yeah. People do, you know, look at something like the Blair Witch Project where they rip up the map, or in Jaws is a great example. Okay, so what they could have done to kill that shark would have been calling the Coast Guard to help them out. But the reason they couldn't do it is at one point they didn't have a radio anymore because Quint destroyed it. But he did that because Brody's wife was calling him all the time and he couldn't. He didn't even want those guys on his ship, and he was going to be damned if he was going to have a woman telling him what to do, too. So he knocked the whole thing out, which was consistent with his character. So that was a dumb thing to do, but it made sense. And you might not think about those issues, but there were reasons earlier that the wife was around and certain conversations they had to set up them getting that radio out of the picture. So you got to think about that stuff. It's really intricate, and it's something that a good master storyteller is going to do really well. And we're just pointing out if I'm asking why would they do something like that, then there's a problem.
Yeah. Andrew Brown writes, the greatest and frankly the only one I found worth reading. There are others, but just ugh. Medical science fiction is Sector General. I've read them all and read them again every few years, and they are amazing. Some of the science is very aged, but the stories are beautiful and amazing. To paraphrase what someone else said about the books, it's a universe you'd actually like to live in.
Have you heard of those before?
I've never heard of Sector General, but it sounds great. So I'm definitely going to track down some of that stuff.
Yeah, I am too, because I was saying that Space Hospital is like my favorite potential genre. So I'm definitely going to track those down. A lot of people agreed. So thank you guys, Sector General. All right. I love hearing about something new.
Me too.
Speaking of space, I made some cracks in this episode about the intro there was a Martian hour. I only have a few Martian hours left to live. And I thought, mm-hmm. well, that's kind of a weird way to say it if another human's going to be reading this. And I felt like it was a little in that, I'm having some space water in my space canteen, you know. But some people pointed some things out. A goblin that lives in a cave wrote, Martian hours are different from Earth hours. At least Martian days are different. The length of time it takes Mars to rotate on its axis is in Earth time 24 hours, 39 minutes, and 35 seconds, so a little longer. For this reason, NASA's rovers measure time in sols, NASA's term for Martian days. Philip K. Dick and Kim Stanley Robinson thought humans living on Mars would deal with the time difference by having a normal 24-hour clock that would stop for 39 minutes every day in a sort of Martian witching hour before turning over. But David Powell, I like the dramatic implications of that, mm-hmm. you know, what happens in the Martian witching hour. But David Powell thought that humans cum Martians could go native and more radically adjust their whole timekeeping system. Well, folks, guess what? We also received an email after this episode, and it was maybe the most starstruck I've been in a long time getting this email. And remember, guys, I killed Ray Bradbury, so that's saying a lot. Here's the email. Hello, Chad and Chris. I discovered you guys recently after getting a copy of the complete works of H.P. Lovecraft. I love the pod. It's a great way to escape the horrors of everyday life with some much more manageable supernatural horrors. I wanted to write in because I finally have something to contribute. In the story, Rodney Severn only has a few Martian hours of life remaining. I am a Martian mission specialist. I operate cameras on the Curiosity rover, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and the recently landed Perseverance rover. Since Perseverance landed, the rover team and I have been living on Mars time to ensure maximum efficiency during rover operations. A Martian day, called a sol, is roughly 24 hours and 40 minutes long, so actually very close to the Earth day. This makes a Martian hour about 61 minutes in 40 seconds. So that's how much he had a few of those left to live. Mm-hmm. Since I'm living my life on a Mars schedule, this means that my shift start time changes by 40 minutes every day. So there's the answer to the question. Mm-hmm. 1 week, my schedule will be pretty close to a normal Earth schedule, but will slowly progress through a cycle of waking up at 6 a.m., then noon, then 6 p.m., then midnight, and so on. After waking up at a normal time, it takes about a month to go full circle and come back to waking up at a decent hour. I've spent many nights listening to you guys and walking around at 3 a.m., so thank you for the spooks, the laughs, and for making the sols pass a little bit quicker. Cheers and keep up the good work. Mason Starr. First of all, successful joke, because even if you didn't like it, I got clapped back from a goblin in a cave and a Martian mission specialist, which is pretty great range. I was so excited about this.
Me
you know,
too.
I called
you. Of course
you,
we were.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We're going crazy about it. So we reached out to Mason and we asked him if he would be willing to do a bonus episode for us, be our guest. And we would just talk about Mars and the Mars rovers and all that stuff that we love about space travel so much. And he agreed. So our bonus episode this month, at the end of the month, is going to be talking about Mars.
Yeah, we're interviewing Mason Starr, and we already did it. It's a little AV Club. I haven't listened to it yet, but I felt a little AV Club because it's one of those things I didn't realize. I think it's a good interview. I'm just talking about myself personally. I thought, this is going to be a great interview. I got so many things to ask. And then when I arrived, I realized I just wanted to tell him I think he's cool. You know, it was like I didn't really have any questions at all, as it turned out. I was just like, I love space. And he was like, yeah, man, me too. You know, okay. So tune in for that. I think it's going to be a really fun show.
Peter Larson writes, a few points. One, Chad has been pushing a little mummy for your tummy for years now, and suddenly he's against huffing mummy dust for fun. Someone is in the pocket of Big Mummy. That's clear.
Yeah, I mean, I wish that were true.
I want to know more about these independent mummies that are out there trying to make it.
Off-brand mummies.
One passionate advocate for cat-based space travel, or CBST, writes, it's probably been said, can't read all the comments, but that hasn't stopped me from pressing onward before. But I wonder if the portrayals of scientists as careless and ultimately responsible for their own misfortune, as evidenced by the last few stories, has to do with the attitude of the public, or at least these authors, toward science going too far. Sort of like how Alien was in many ways a commentary on capitalism, the crew of the Nostromo only ended up in the path of the Xenomorph because the company wanted money. And in fact, the decision to break quarantine was ultimately facilitated by the company acting through Ash, which we were just talking about. I'd like my recognized theme award now, please. Well, CBST, I'd like to hand this award to you. There you go.
See, now CBST is something I could have talked to Mason about. What would be involved in making a cat rocket? That would have been a wonderful... But I didn't want to embarrass myself.
No.
Because generally, greed is the fatal flaw in these kinds of stories. But again, that only works if the character knows better. Yeah. So they commit an act of greed, even though they know it might endanger other people. And then you want to see them be punished. It's rare that I like someone being punished just because they're dumb.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
No.
By a monster.
Because a lot of times I'm dumb and I relate to them.
Yeah, and I don't want them to get hurt because I know what it's like to be dumb.
Yep.
You know, science going too far, it's obviously very in the zeitgeist right now because of the vaccines, and there's some people who don't want to get the vaccines. I've talked to a couple people who are suspicious about it, and you know, it's funny how I quickly get on the side of science. So, and I want everybody to get the vaccine. If anybody listens to me, please go get it. If you like blindly taking orders from me for any reason, I'm giving you one.
Look, I've talked to doctors. I've personally talked to multiple doctors about the vaccine and the vaccination process and everything that's going on. And they all 100% say that you should do it.
Yeah.
Also, the coronavirus is quite real and quite deadly.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, I've met people that don't think that it's really happening, that the government is blowing it out of proportion, or that it's like a pharma plot, or all these things. It's
Well, I talked to somebody and said, I've had some friends out here that have passed away from coronavirus, and somebody I talked to was like, oh, wow, oh, we didn't really have that here. Well, what does that mean? I'm not making it up. Just because you didn't have it there doesn't mean you won't have it there. Like, I don't know. It was just interesting because that same person I got to admit, being a little derisive toward. Come on, man, just get it. You know, stop being so dumb. It's, you know what I enjoyed when I was growing up? Not having tuberculosis. That's what I said. I was
or polio.
Then I sat down and was opening a thing about Mike Nichols, the director, famous comedian. You know, he lost all of his hair as a child. He was a little... Uncle Fester running around. He was completely bald, no eyebrows, and they fled Germany because of obviously the Nazism and stuff like that. So he was actually, they had to put a sign on him when they came over on the boat that said, don't touch my child, because a little bald kid inspired compassion in people and they were always grabbing him. Anyway, he got that problem was because he took a whooping cough vaccine that immediately caused that problem. There is precedent for these types of things really causing trouble. And it was just interesting because I was so derisive. And then I sat down, this comment made me think of it. I sat down. That was the very next thing I read. So, okay. Yeah. Also, trusting the government, you know, that's kind of a difficult thing to do for me and for anybody, you know. And so I understand the suspicion. And that's why it's good to talk to your physician, talk to people who know what they, you know.
Talk to doctors. Talk to people that are actually out there dealing with it. And I've talked to nurses as well. People that are like, I've watched people die. We were at capacity at the hospital. I was just talking to my son's audiologist who works at the hospital this week. And he was just like, we were at capacity. We didn't have any room and people were coming in and we had to turn them away. And that's never happened. And I go, that's never happened with like the flu. And he looked at me like I was crazy. And he's like, no, of course that's never happened with the flu. And I'm like, I've heard people say that this is actually no worse than the flu. What are you basing that on? Who are you talking to?
I don't know. Obviously I live in a big city, but they put up a big mobile morgue in the park over there.
Yeah.
They weren't keeping ice cream in it. And like, it's affected me very personally. But you know what? People aren't also understanding that because of the lockdown, it gives you less access to things that are happening in society too. My Uncle Bruce passed away in this period, which I think I mentioned on the show. I don't even know if I'd be doing this if it weren't for him. Well, I still don't know what happened. He might have died from coronavirus. He just died in his apartment. I don't know. There's that going on too. Anyway, I understand suspicion of science. Completely, I guess, because we're in the middle of this stuff. So it was an interesting comment. And I think that that does play culturally into these things where, just like we talked about in them, and we're getting to that in a second, the minute they announced something nice about science on the radio, the ants showed up to eat everybody's rib cages. So, you know, I think that's definitely going on here.
Yeah.
On to comments, episode number 36, Instructions on How to Get Killed. Dylan Winslow writes, seeing the title of this episode was one of the happiest moments of my life. Aww. And I assume that's because we lifted the title from his comment, although I also thought, wait, if we didn't, then Dylan, give me a call, because Instructions on How to Get Killed, what have you been waiting so long for? These aren't real instructions, man.
Mark Saunders writes, to answer your questions about Kolchak, The Vampire was an episode of the TV show, which was a sequel to the original Night Stalker movie, in which one of the vampires managed to escape at the end of the movie.
Got it. Mary Kate Jenkins writes, oh man, the March Draculas was a perfect touch, topped only by Chris's rendition of Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush from years ago. That is a consistent reoccurring hit, by the way.
I forgot all about that.
I did. See, I see a bunch of these comments on email that you don't see. It comes up, nothing to do with the show. And people be like, remember when Chris sang Wuthering Heights? Like, what? It's a hit. I remember running inside right after I heard that, immediately playing it again for my father, who is the biggest Kate Bush fan I know. You two are the absolute best. It's so good that she played it for the biggest Kate Bush fan. And normally you would think that would make him mad, but she had that much confidence in the material.
That he's going to love it. Wow.
Guaca writes, all jokes aside, the March Draculas are exactly my kind of music. It had a real Eels feeling to it. I'd buy it. Right. You know, the thing is about, I can't get a band that hates themselves that much. I hate them. Christopher Knox writes, Chris Creepy Whispering Marches for Dracula in April made my day. That's good. Look at all the magic you're spreading.
I know. I didn't know it was possible. I just thought I was some guy eating some fish.
You're just shooting stars out of your hands like a wizard.
Elizabeth Holbrook writes, I've been a listener for a while, and I just want to say I always enjoy your energy and enthusiasm when discussing all these great and not so great stories. Keep up the good work. Also, a suggestion for bonus content for the next March is for Dracula's is a short three-act play, about 20 pages, called Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. It's a satirical play written by Charles Bush, originally premiering in 1984.
I think that somebody did that at my college. I know the title. I'm going to have to ask Matt Barisi about that. He's going to be like, it was you, man. We were in that together. Episode 544, The Hanging Stranger.
Kate Sherrod writes, I'm a dick chick, and I'm here to tell you all that Philip K. Dick hasn't really messed with your head until you've read his literary fiction. Get your eyes on In Milton Lunky Territory. No androids, no drugs, no spaceships, just the ordinary, highly functional economic reality of the mid-20th century America, where a dude could make a living selling typewriters. It's still the weirdest thing I've ever read, and I'm also a Gene Wolfe fan. Steve, TV shops are big in Dr. Blood Money. He also had a protagonist who works in record shops, etc. Have a look at the film adaptation of Radio Free Albemuth, by the way. Best Philip K. Dick adaptation since A Scanner Darkly.
You know, you don't have to. I didn't know he had literary fiction stuff, but I'll definitely check that out.
John Hancock writes, on the subject of mystical truths being revealed following medical drug use, this has long been a favorite of mine. The 19th century U.S. philosopher William James described a man who got the experience from laughing gas. Whenever he was under its influence, he knew the secret of the universe, but when he came to, he had forgotten it. At last, with immense effort, he wrote down the secret before the vision had faded. When completely recovered, he rushed to see what he had written. It was, a smell of petroleum prevails throughout.
The secret of the universe? I don't know if that's a secret, really. Petroleum is a fossil fuel, right? So there's more, it's just the smell of dead things.
I've heard of people doing that, you know, like getting high and then writing jokes or trying to write a screenplay or...
Oh, of course. Running Head writes, Chris and Chad owe me a butt because K-Dick is huge right now, made me laugh my ass off. All right, put a butt on my balance sheet.
There you
go. 101. This was something I was trying to figure out. Squirrely Wrath wrote, help, I think I'm going insane. When the episode started, the story sounded so familiar. I knew what story beats were coming, what they were going to talk about next. I've never read this story before, or any PKD for that matter. I swear I've heard Chris and Chad discuss the story before. Is there another two-man weird fiction podcast that covers this? Probably. There's a lot of them. Yeah. I mean, it's Philip K. Dick, so it's not like nobody's ever heard of him, but damn, I swear it was this one. Weirdest case of deja vu ever. I was just thinking maybe they're... It was Mimic that they were thinking about. Because a couple of people chimed in and said, dude, I had the same experience.
Yeah, it might have. We covered Mimic, or you're having some kind of premonition in your psychic.
Oh, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Episode 545, Fondly Fahrenheit. We got so much love for your song, Chad. It is so good. And I am so proud of just saying some words and then you making magic out of those words.
You know, it'd be really funny if from this one episode we took the message out of it that we should be musicians, stop doing the show, immediately failed at everything. That would be amazing. You know what's crazy about that is for the one day, because I read that story in the morning, we recorded the show in the afternoon, and I said, you know, I needed to work on some music that wasn't the band because I'm in the middle of doing that album. And so I was like, I got to go do something else for a minute because I'm running into some trouble. So send me over your audio so I can make a song out of this. And I did it that night. So read it in the morning, did a podcast on it in the afternoon, wrote a song about it in the night. I was the biggest fan of Fondly Fahrenheit for 24 hours that there has ever been.
Yeah.
I covered the gamut of fandom in that one day.
You did. If people haven't listened to the song, they need to listen to the song. I can't get enough of it. Rachel can't get enough of it. We're all just like, it's so catchy and there's something really uplifting about it, but there's also kind of some subversive creepiness to it. It's just like, it's so good.
It's good. The Toddling Chaos writes, the android struggled with the flipping between points of view. Then I decided I liked it. Richard Horseman writes, the last bester I read was The Deceivers, which imagine the tone of Playboy's party jokes page stretched out to novel length. Ugh. This was much, much better and was a reminder of how good Bester at his best is.
Shoggoth Lord writes, funnily enough, when Chris was talking about the ubiquity of psionics in sci-fi in the first place, my mind went to Babylon 5, where one of the peeps is even named Alfred Bester. And that cold son of a bitch was played by Walter Koenig, trying to get, tying this back to Rachel Watches Star Trek. There you go. I knew that Walter Koenig played Alfred Bester on there. I forgot to mention it, and I honestly just didn't make the connection.
Sanjay Matthew writes, hooray, I came here to say basically this. Also, I think psychic powers in science fiction comes out of that early 20th century assumption that the new science of psychology would potentially unlock human psychic potential. It's woo to us, but sci-fi, from the 1890s to 1940s perspective, and got a booster shot with the 60s New Age stuff. Kit Ainsley feels the same way. He says, I definitely think psionics are one of those weird holdovers from the early days of sci-fi, where psychology's investigation into the mind and the CIA's investigation into psychedelics retreated with real scientific scrutiny. A lot of early sci-fi included psychic abilities as part of the projection of modern sciences forward, just like today modern science and technology has inspired things like Black Mirror and Interstellar. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with all that. I mean, I'm still okay with it. And in fact, when you guys were calling it woo, I was like, what's wrong with that? That sounds great. That's a fun sound. That's the sound you make on roller coasters. I like woo. You got to pick it better.
No, it's just saying that there, in nature, it doesn't exist where somebody sends some kind of brain waves to another creature. Like, there's no part of our brain that can perceive brain waves, or any creature in reality can do that. So the idea that this could be part of a science fiction is, it's more on the magical end of things. You can come up with some very complicated scientific way of doing it, where you get a chip in your head and then you send a Wi-Fi signal and somebody else has got the chip and then they've got it. So that's technically, but not really. It's not what these things are talking about. It's not what the science fiction was. Auntie Lasco writes, this story reminds me of the Susie and the Banshees song 92 Degrees. It has a great intro quote from the movie It Came from Outer Space. Did you know, Putnam, that more murders are committed at 92 Fahrenheit than any other temperature? I read in an article, lower temperatures, people are easygoing. Over 92, it's too hot to move. But just 92, people get irritable.
Yep, that's in the song. That is my favorite Susie album, Tinderbox. Yeah. And I put two tracks from that album on my new Night Creeps playlist from last week.
Boom.
Remember, it updates every Friday with a new hour. Tune in.
And lastly, we're going to finish up with Them, our bonus episode for the month. Rob Gilley writes, this was just a super, super discussion of a movie with lots of lovely ant facts to know and tell, and also the insight that these movies are always about something more than just giant ants rampaging through LA sewers. But William Shallert played Nils Barris, the annoying Federation Undersecretary for Agricultural Affairs in The Trouble with Tribbles, not the Klingon agent disguised as a smarmy human. Also, yes, Phase 4 is definitely worth consideration as another movie about something more than just ants building monoliths out in the Arizona desert. So, yeah, I got that wrong. I'm a bad Trekkie. I'm sorry.
We got stuff wrong all over the place in this episode. Shoggoth Lord was slightly annoyed in this episode. He wrote, Chad, the reason people say ants don't have lungs is because they just don't. They've got a system that... It's pretty funny. They've got a system that fills a similar role, but the whole mechanism is different. A lung is a sac that inflates and deflates to circulate air. That is the only thing a lung is.
Yeah.
When people say cars don't have legs and then describe tires, do you say, well, they just don't have human legs? Yeah, maybe I would say that, Shoggoth Lord. Nah, you're totally right. It is funny, though, that question only works if I do say, of course, I wouldn't say that, you know, because I remember one time, per our earlier discussion this episode, I was having an argument with a friend about getting somebody who doesn't know anything about politics to be a politician. I understand the allure a little bit, but I said, I mean, don't you want them to know something? I mean, would you go, I have a plumbing problem and get somebody over here who's not a plumber because I need it fixed. And he said, yeah, I might do that. I thought, well, shit, I'm never using that argument again. Kind of falls apart if the other person's not reasonable.
Yeah. Patrick Ferguson writes, I'm a millennial, but Them was one of my favorite movies as a kid, as I was really into ants and often had an ant farm.
You know, I know we grouse about being older on the show sometimes, but why did you feel the need to point out that you're a millennial? It's not like I watched this was my movie. I wasn't like watching this when I was a teenager. I was really touched by the fondness folks had for this movie as something that they could share with older family members.
Yeah.
Ulthar Meow wrote, "Wow, this episode brings back great memories. Sitting on the couch with my mom watching this on HBO back when it was still called Home Box Office. The Blob immediately aired after them. Great double feature." Oh, I agree. I just watched The Blob recently. That's an awesome great. Movie. "To this day, my 70-year-old mom and I still wiggle our fingers above our heads like antennae and make the ant sound. Growing up is overrated."
Yeah.
Agreed. And then Steve writes, "When I was about 6 or 7, my brother snuck downstairs late one night while my parents were watching them. He saw some of it from behind the sofa until they discovered him, and then they let him watch the rest of the movie. The next day, he told me how great it was. Still not seen it." I thought, of course you haven't seen it. You're busy reading everything. You don't have time for sci-fi movies. But that's so cool because I have a kind of gooey feelings about that movie, too. It's just one of those great ones you can share with anybody. And it's weirdly a good family movie. You know, it's great for kids. One last correction on that episode. Which I mentioned in another episode this month, but Bob Sharp wrote, "His name was Brooks. The thing he carved on the beam was Brooks was here. Red was Morgan Freeman's character."
Oh, yeah.
I called him Red.
Yep.
It's confusing because Morgan Freeman carves "So Was Red" on the beam after Brooks was here, which is why I was conflating the two.
Oh, right. Oh,
names.
God, I forgot all about that. Yeah, yeah.
Because he takes the same apartment later. So, you know, I know the movie in and out, and I know it's just having a brain fart. And Dracula Sucks wrote, "I always remember this because in the book he was called Red because the color of his hair, and in the movie they cast Morgan Freeman, who is not a redhead."
Oh, yeah.
So it was interesting that he kept the name. Yeah, so we screwed up a couple of things, but still... them as a good movie. We couldn't stop that from being true.
Well, I hope you guys all enjoyed us reading your comments and then talking about them, because that's what we do every month, and we wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't for your support.
That's absolutely correct. We love you, and we hope you keep tuning in. We've got more good Sword and Sorcery stuff coming up this month. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the HP Podcraft Comment Show.
Only on Patreon.
HPPodcraft.com.